We start the new year reading on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today we look at books we've read, want to read, or reread on Scribble. And we start the year in an appropriately disorganized fashion, talking about nothing in particular, but boy, you know, we've been at this a while.
4 years.
4 years.
And 2 months.
It's been a while.
And we duplicated 5 different people? I mean,
I think it's up to 7.
That is how many people in some way or another involve reading. Or selling books.
Yeah, or writing.
Or writing books.
So many authors in the area, and we have so many more to go. It's just amazing. But I thought today we would start off by just talking about books that we've read that we found interesting, or books. Do you reread books?
I do. I reread just this past year The Brothers K.
Oh, really? I should go back to that.
I do it every 10 years or so. And the thing is, there are so many new books coming out.
Yeah.
You know, the lists this past year from all the various Chicago Tribune and stuff, instead of the best 10 books of the year, are now up to the best 50 books of the year or the best 100 books of the year. Or a new book that just came out last year, 1,000 books you have to read before you die. And why they will change you.
I'm running out of time, Tweet.
So to go back and, you know, every time I even read a paragraph that someone else quotes from Moby Dick, I want to go back and read Moby Dick again, too, because it's a different book if you come to it after, you know. Well, if you turned right around and read Jane Austen again, it would be a different book. And if you read it a third time the next week, it would be a different book. Because you see something, and you're different because you've read that book.
The only book that I've reread too much, maybe, is The Lord of the Rings. But that's because of the unusual circumstance in which I was introduced to it. I've mentioned there's a little book nook or something over where the Adler is now, the Arco Orpheum. There was a little bookstore next to it, and they had a tray out in front with books for a quarter, and I picked up one called Fellowship of the Ring. It's a little bit beaten, but what the heck.
Right.
I gave it to Bernadette, who liked to read at night. She'd read a page and be sound asleep. But this book kept her awake, and she kept commenting, what an extraordinary story this is. And when she said, I don't know how they're going to finish it because I'm almost down to the end, and she let out a wail, says, it can't stop here. I thought, what goes on? And I found out it was a trilogy, and I had to send to Blackwell's in England to get the complete book. And she was just fascinated by it, so I thought, well, I should read this. And I started out and thought, this is still the silliest thing I've ever read. Little, you know,
right.
Hobbits, fur in their
right.
feet, 71st birthday party, come on. But by the time I got to the end at Bree, I was so hooked in that book that I raced through it and immediately reread it slowly. And I reread it every year for the next 5 years.
You know, you and Tom Treadway are probably among the very first people in the Quad Cities to have read that book.
It was amazing. It was a whole world, many worlds, complete. An absolute act of total creation that not only did Tolkien create this world, but there were adjacent worlds, and he created languages to go with each world and each tribe in each world. And how did he do that? It was just staggering. I could not get over that. You have to go back to the great medieval romances, the Romance of the Rose or something like that, to find something to, you know, to compare it with. There's just nothing like it.
It does all come together, right?
Yeah.
You know, it little bits and pieces come from this part of our culture and that part of our culture, but he fuses them into something brand new.
Yeah, he wanted to create an early history for England, and boy, he did something extraordinary. But I went into a bookstore not long ago, and there were three books there that I just picked up one after the other. The one was Debussy, A Life Painted in Sound, something like that, by Stephen Walsh. Then I also picked up the book Born to be Posthumous by Mark Derry about Edward Gorey. I didn't know anything about Gorey, but I recognized that he was definitely a strange person. And then I wanted to also look at this book on Edward Lear, A Life in Paint and Nonsense, because yes, Mr. Lear, A Life of Art and Nonsense by Jenny Uglow. And that book has really occupied me. I have been reading it, and I can't decide what to make of it other than it is a complete life. And I mean complete because she takes us through every year of his life and all the people he knew and how he was formed by the people. He was one of 18 or 19 children. His mother couldn't remember the exact number because not all survived. And he was a very different kid. He was homosexual, but he never was able to admit that in a society that not only did not have language for it, but they put you in prison for it. And he talks about something unspeakable that happened to him 1 year in his life when he was at school. He never explained what it was. But every year of his life in his diary, he made note of it, the anniversary of that event. He started out as a painter. He became, parrots were his passion, and he became a great naturalist. I mean, he was admired and acknowledged all over. And then he started writing nonsense poetry. That was two sides of this man. He kept moving down to the Mediterranean, but he'd go back to London to make a living. I can't decide whether it was a sad life, and yet he was the center of the party everywhere he went. He was the great amuser. People loved to have him around. And at the end, you know, it's the nonsense that we remember. The dog with the luminous nose, right, and the owl and the pussycat. But his paintings were extraordinary.
Never seen any.
Yeah, nor have I, except in this book.
Wow.
Yeah, it is an amazing life. I'm not through with it yet, but Debussy I've wanted to read because it's the 100th anniversary of his death this last year. It was, you know, we were completely caught up in the 100th anniversary of Bernstein's birth, but Debussy was a much more consequential composer, regarded as old hat in his short life, and yet we now recognize him as one of the great turning points in musical composition. Extraordinary stuff, but boy, what a life, you know. He drank a lot. He was careless in his choice of women. His first wife committed suicide in the Place de la Concorde. She shot herself so everybody would know. And later on, you know, when he married a woman he had an affair with, Marie Rosalie Texier, he wrote songs for her, which seemed the very expression of that woman. So that's a book I got. But Gorey, I've got to read that one. I haven't read it, but I want to read that. Those three books captured my attention, and I'm devoting as much time as I can spare to reading them. Anything grab you this year?
In thinking about, you know, I got to thinking along a little different lines from you, not new books that I haven't read, but But the idea of even doing a New Year's resolution of books, assigning yourself a task to accomplish in reading over the following year. And that led me, in some weird way, late at night, to remembering in 1968, I believe it was, as the Vietnam crisis was, the Democratic Convention was a debacle that year, Augustana brought Dick Gregory to campus, the black comedian who was anti-war. And he was introduced, and he got up and opened a book and started reading it. Gregory was much more militant and anti-war than the Augustana audience. And the Augustana audience had just voted. I mean, that was student body had just voted on the Vietnam War. Should we get out of Vietnam, maintain the status quo, or escalate? And escalate the war won the vote.
Oh, my.
Okay. So that's the kind of audience. And Gregory started reading this document, which was fairly strange and weird. And and within 2 minutes, there was a boo from some student that had the guts to boo. And then all of a sudden, there were catcalls and boos and hiss, you know, in opposition to what he was reading. Can you guess what he was reading from?
Declaration of Independence.
The Constitution of the United States of America. And I got to wondering how many, and that includes me, have ever read the Constitution about which we are now fretting so much.
Oh, yeah.
It might not be a bad idea somewhere in your reading this year to pick up a copy of the Constitution. And I mean, that was absolutely, you know, he finally revealed what he was reading from, and it blew everybody away. So my first recommendation is, if you haven't read the Constitution, which has created all kinds of fights and arguments and bad feelings this year, read it.
Yeah,
and
that's
see
true.
What it really says. And then make up your mind about whether you're going to be a strict constitutionalist or somebody who says the Constitution was a starting point, but only that. You know, I mean, there are arguments on both sides.
That's true. The people who wrote the Constitution were not satisfied with it. But the thing is, that is the organizing document. And we're different from other countries because England lived on the common law, which was decided in court.
Right.
And when a judge made a decision in court, that became, unless someone challenged it seriously in another court, that became the law of the land. They did not have a written constitution. And the founders of this country were determined that we were going to work this out, that we were going to put it in writing. And they were creatures of the Enlightenment, but they were running up against slave owners. And how you could bring together people of the Enlightenment and those who own slaves and make one country out of that, boy, that took compromise. And the compromises were uneasy and unsatisfactory on both sides, but they compromised. And then they set up the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court really formed itself. It decided that it was the final arbiter of what was the law. And you can thank John Marshall for that. I mean, the way it all came together is fascinating reading, but the Constitution itself, you're right. There's so many people that claim to be constitutionalists and don't know what's in there.
Well, I don't think, I mean, I have not read it. I listened to Dick Gregory's part of it, and but, you know, so I'm going to go and read it.
Parts of it are really confusing.
Well, they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you will see where the arguments come from, and then you can decide on what side you are going to be on in this debate. But right now, everybody fighting over it without having the slightest idea of what it really is.
And look at the Commerce Clause, because that is the basis for almost all regulatory agencies. And when they made a decision on the Affordable Care Act, people call Obamacare, the basis for it, as in all regulation, was the Commerce Clause. But the Supreme Court dismissed that. And everybody figured, well, that takes care of that.
Right.
But then Justice Roberts cited the ability to tax. But I thought, is he doing something clever here? Is he setting the ground for undoing regulatory agencies by saying the Commerce Clause did not apply here and there was a 5-4 decision on that? I mean, that right. was – but he turned 5-4 in favor of the act, but by citing a different basis. So, yeah, you ought to know the Constitution. You ought to know how it has been interpreted, too, because it has been interpreted.
Well, that would be a start to read the Constitution, and then – then you could spend the rest of your life reading books about it.
Yeah, because right? what you have to acknowledge, the originalist argument is nonsense. Because if you want to know the original intent of those who wrote the Constitution, you've got to read all the papers that Paine and the others wrote and Hamilton and see what they had in mind.
Well, maybe I have opened a can of worms here then, suggesting.
Oh, yeah, it's... why do we have the Second Amendment, which is so controversial? And if you read the Second Amendment and you looked at the way the Constitution was framed, why shouldn't the Southern states be allowed to secede if they wanted to? They insisted they were being constitutional
right.
in secession. And we decided in blood that no.
Right.
That was a hard way to make a decision. Yeah, Constitution's a good subject. But it'll just get you started.
Well, I have one more book to get you started.
Okay.
The Bible.
Ah, there's a toughie.
You know, we call ourselves the people of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how many people have ever actually read, sat down, and started at Genesis 1:1 and read through Revelations. You know, we get little bits and pieces in church on Sunday. And every 3 years, it's the same set of little stories that we get. But I think to read the entire Bible as a book might cause you some sleepless nights.
That's true. I know one person who has read the Bible straight through twice and also read the Quran. And she's now a Buddhist.
Well, anyway, there are things going on there that are really interesting. And Northrop Frye, the literary critic who revolutionized modern literary criticism in the 1950s, wrote a book called The Great Code, in which he suggested that however sloppy and political a way the books of the Bible got there and got in the order— and the fact that most of them were not written by the people who said they, you know, St. Matthew didn't write Matthew, and Luke didn't write Luke, and Paul didn't write half of what he's ascribed to in the New Testament. Nevertheless, at the end, every book, he says, in the Great Code is in its proper place. And therefore, it needs to be read the way we read any text, all the way through, not little stories cherry-picked from here and there.
Well, you know, what's interesting is to read a parallel Bible when you've got different translations on the same page.
Right.
And to read it that way. And that is interesting. I've got one of those that I've gone through.
Right.
But the thing that fascinates me is we talk about the Bible, you know, that it's unalterable. Well, it's been changed all kinds of ways over time. The Bible has been, well, for example, the story of the woman taken in adultery. That didn't show up in any text
right.
for about 300 years after the Bible had been organized. Oh, where did that come from? That's the most popular story in the Bible, too. So it's an interesting thing to read. And the thing that fascinates me is the first book of the Bible ends before there's any suggestion of a resurrection at all. And then the verses were added to it later on to make it conform, particularly to the Gospel of John. That was the last one, and that was the one that made the strongest claims for the divinity of Jesus. And the other Gospels then had to be seen in the light of John. It's interesting, the influence Greeks had on the Hebrew Bible.
Right.
It's fascinating stuff.
Well, most of the text that comes down to us is in Greek, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And a lot of it is poorly translated.
Right, yeah.
It is poorly translated from the original Hebrew or Aramaic.
So now, again, you've gotten our readers in a pickle because just to read the Bible isn't enough, right? I was thinking maybe if we just sat down and read the book that we're the people of.
I've spent life reading about the Bible, the comments on the Bible, the studies of the Bible, and so on. And it is a fascinating and somewhat overwhelming subject.
I just finished a book by Elaine Pagels. She's the one that has done so much with the Gnostic Gospels on the book of Revelations.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, first of all, why in the world is that book in the Bible?
Yeah, it doesn't make
sense. Because it is a very strange book. But also it turns out there were at least 20 other versions of Revelations by different writers. And she has an interesting take on why this particular book out of all, and they're all equally strange,
mm-hmm.
why this book was the one picked to be the end book in the Bible.
Or why they even bothered.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see that.
But, anyway, there's something for you to do this year.
Oh, yeah.
Two books, the Constitution and the Bible. Plus, it's very difficult to read any earlier literature, Melville, for instance. I mean, you can't read a page of Melville without some biblical reference being there. And if you miss it, you miss a lot of what's in Melville.
Elaine Pagels likes the Gospel of St. Thomas.
Right.
And that's a Gnostic work. And I like that, too. I think that's a fascinating book. And there's some sayings in there. I shouldn't try to quote because I can't do it exactly, but someone's asking him about paradise, and he says it's spread out before you. Just look around. And I've thought, yeah, this world is paradise. We just don't see it.
The kingdom of God is within you.
Yeah. And talking to Hindus about that God is within you and you just need to bring God out. Fascinating how we have tried to come to terms with life and how we've tried to understand things. And the problem is we tell one story and we decide that's it. But really, there are other stories that are very interesting and persuasive. It's all coming back to that business of what is life. It's, Elaine Pagels has just written a book, too, a personal book. About
a memoir.
Yeah, a memoir. And by the way, I just ran across a book that I read some time ago by Edward O. Wilson, who is, I think, the great biologist of our time. And I think it's just called Naturalist. And it is really a story of his life. I've read his other books, Consilience, and where he talks about sociobiology and a lot of things. But I think The Naturalist gives you a feel for the quality of his thought and something of his life. And just running across that. I also ran across Max Schulman's Barefoot Boy with Cheek.
They don't write books like that anymore.
They don't. That was hysterical. There's one whole chapter that ends in a pun. Every character in there is named Max. He
right.
says, false modesty, no fall. All my characters are named Max. And S.J. Perlman, I lived on S.J. Perlman when I was younger. He is so funny. And the older I got, the funnier he got. There's so many good books back there that I will never go back to because I have this Sundoku, finally found a term for it, too many unread books in the house.
Right.
You buy a book and you think, I've got to read this, but in the meantime, I'm reading this.
And then, the minute I think about these big topics, then I come back to the local writers, many of whom we've interviewed, who really are writing interesting stuff, and they're worth paying attention to, too. So, skip the Constitution and skip the Bible. go to a local bookstore.
Now make up your mind, Tweet. What do you want us to do?
I can't. You know, another interesting thing, and I've done it twice, is to read everything that one author wrote. You know, tendency is to pick up a Steinbeck book and read maybe two more, or a Faulkner book and read maybe two more, or Hemingway and maybe read three more. But you really get something. And I've done this to D.H. Lawrence. I picked up a copy in Great Falls, Montana of Sons and Lovers. Never heard of D.H. Lawrence and couldn't put it down. Read the novels. And eventually I ended up, you know, ordering 1932 magazines that had an article by D.H. Lawrence in it. And I think I have read 99% of everything D.H. Lawrence wrote. And what a different idea you get about a person if you read the body of that person's works rather than just skim a couple of novels and go on to the next novelist.
I've only done that in a minor field, in detective stories. When I find a good detective story writer, I want his first book, particularly if he sticks with one character, right, and then follow that character all the way through. Robinson does a great thing, and his Detective from York. I've read all of his books, but it's important, I think, to start with the first one just to see how the character develops. But that's a daunting task, Tweet. It's taken you a lifetime, hasn't it?
Any one thing we've suggested today, you can't finish in a year, right?
Well, why did you even bring it up then?
Well, because you asked me to think about what we should, you know, any suggestions for reading in the new year. And, you know, I do like to find things by accident.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, there are things which have shaped our culture about which most of us remain relatively ignorant.
But sometimes books just hit you. We mentioned off mic that shortly after my wife died, I walked into a bookstore, and there was a book, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? And I thought, well, I've got to read that book. And then next to it was Gone Girl, right. And I thought, yeah, I'll buy them both and read them.
Right.
Well, Where'd You Go, Bernadette is a delightful story. Gone Girl is, I wanted to throw the book against the wall when I finished it. That doesn't mean it wasn't a great book, but I just, it didn't turn out well. But that's it. Sometimes you just chance on a book and read it, and sometimes you throw it away, and sometimes you find your life has been changed somewhat. Your suggestion of the Constitution, the Bible, is not bad.
No, I think, I mean, it will change the way you see things.
Yeah. I know I got started on that because I had to read the Illinois Constitution if I wanted to be a senator. And actually, if I wanted to be a teacher, you had to read it. But once you're in the legislature, yeah, you've got to know that. And so necessity sometimes leads you into these things. But whether it's necessity or pleasure, I don't think you can spend time any better way than with a good book. And choosing that good book, well, I guess we'll leave up to you. And that'll do it. We've launched into a new year here, and with nothing specific, but just an interesting conversation. We'll be back next week with more traditional fare. I'm Don Woot with Roll Tweet. Join us next week for the next Scribble.